The Craftsman, copyright 2020, from the book The Vermilion Book of the Macabre, by Joe Pawlowski. They led the merchant in chains up the mountain path to a vast stone house set deep in the woods. To say the house was uninviting would be an understatement. Let's say forbidding. The structure roosted steep in the ground, and was stooped and bowed as if an immense weight had once rested upon it. The stones from which it was composed were darkly weathered, cracked and misshapen, and clustered so tightly together that here and there one threatened to squeeze from the facing. The merchant wondered how stable this ancient place could possibly be. The windows were cavernous rents. The towering front entrance was formed from two half-doors that met at the apex of an arch. They were banded in tarnished brass and constructed of wood generations old. Carved griffins, mossy and wind-eroded, their oversized heads reposing on clenched claws, peered back at the visitors from either side of the entrance, wearing expressions of indifference. A rusty iron fence lined the perimeter of the property. Philin Gaudai, the rough-bearded, sharp-featured leader of the highwaymen, stepped to the fence's gate and loudly rang the clapper on a fist-sized bell, announcing their arrival. "He'll be glad to meet ye, the craftsman will," Philin Gaudai said to the merchant, displaying a broad grin. "He likes them a little chubby. Says it gives him more to work with." The robber winked at him. One half of the great door opened and out shuffled a uniformed woman carrying a spiked mace on one shoulder and a handful of coins. Her uniform was a fringed white robe with chevrons on short sleeves, and it was decorated in oddly shaped metallic badges that appeared to have some official significance. A feathered belt bound her at the waist, and a string of discolored pearls hung from her neck. As she approached, the merchant saw she was covered in thousands of disfiguring tumors of differing sizes, bubbles of flesh on her face and arms and legs, so numerous that they contorted her outline and form. The bronze growth so crowded her features that they buried her nose and lips. Mournful brown eyes peered out from amongst the clutter of them. The pearls this woman wore, the merchant now realized, were human teeth. "Afternoon, Chara," Philin said to her cheerfully. "Those coins are for me, I take it." She nodded. The merchant wondered whether the bumps pained her, but she gave no indication they did. Her eyes turned on him, and he had the sense that she was looking at him with pity, though he couldn't be sure.
"I'll be needing the manacles back," Philin said. "In my line of work, you never know when they'll come in handy."
He removed the heavy chains from the merchant's wrists, and immediately the merchant's arms went lighter. The skin of the wrists was chafed and red. He had worn the manacles for days, and this simple act of removal liberated him on some deeper level. She opened the gate and handed a dozen gold paldens to Philin Gaudai, then she stepped back to give the merchant room for entry.
"As always, a pleasure doing business with ye, Chara," the highwayman said. "Tell the craftsman that when he's ready for another, he can contact me through the usual channels."
The robber and his companions stepped jauntily down the mountain trail as the merchant entered the gate. The woman motioned with her mace, and he walked ahead of her, stepping through the massive threshold into a dimly lit antechamber. Beyond lay a huge stone room. Daylight entered through deep windows on either side, not brilliantly but enough, combined with the light from the fireplace, to give his eyes something to catch on. Finely made settees, benches and chairs faced the hearth. A passage on the far left led to a murky room. On the right lay a stairway that disappeared into the floor. Faded tapestries lined the walls. Nearing the tapestries, he could see in their weaves visions of cruelty and terror. One showed the netherworld with the bull god Osric using his black horns to shovel the gored dead into a fiery pyre. Another, flecked in crimson and gold, pictured dancing devils, their fang teeth gleefully sinking into wailing babies. All the hangings held images straight from Nightmareland, severed heads crawling with spiders, bodiless limbs clawing their way up from oceans of blood, drawn-faced ghouls applauding as tormented, impaled masses writhed. She pointed her spiky mace toward the stairs, and he ambled onward. Ka-thump. Ka-thump. A man's upper torso surfaced hunched at the top of the stairs. The man had a pleasant, bearded face and wore a fringed white uniform like the bubble-fleshed woman, though with different badges. He appeared to be walking on his hands or rather hopping on them as he climbed the steps.
"This the new one then?"
he asked, pausing.
"Aye,"
she said. It was the first the merchant had heard her speak, and he was surprised by her throaty, baritone voice. "Phelan Gowdy just brought him in. Thought I heard a bell ring." With a final effort, he swung above ground to the stone floor, and the bottom half of him, which had been hidden by the stairway, was revealed. The merchant froze in disbelief. The bearded man, normal in every aspect from the waist up, completely lacked the lower portion of his abdomen and his legs. Strolling over on the flat of his hands, the half-man grinned widely at the merchant's reaction. Then he swung off into the subdued light of the next room. The bubble-fleshed woman poked the merchant with her mace, and they moved to the stairs and down them. As he descended, he felt oppression build in the air, felt it pinch at his heart, felt it creep in his gut. At the foot of the stairs, they entered a low-ceilinged, stone corridor that smelled faintly of sweat, vomit, and human waste. Down here, light was precious, cast only by widely spaced wall stanchions with wavering flames. They passed iron doors that failed to contain the moans of those concealed within. Insects gathered to feed on the dark stains of the corridor's dirt floor. The merchant and his keeper came at last to an open chamber, lit only by a few sputtering candles. Two tables rested in the middle of it. One was the size of a medium banquet table. This one was affixed with restraints, and equipped with a drain that emptied into the floor. The second table was smaller. It displayed an assortment of metal clamps, rippers, spike tubes, knives, claw-like devices, brands, and shears. On a near wall hung a collection of manacles and shackles of various shapes and sizes, including restrictive bridles to fit over a face and specialized leg restraints. Near the far wall stood a large metal wheel that resembled a spider web. Blood-stained skewers lined the wheel's outer edge. From out of the darkness came two hooded figures who led the merchant to the larger table. "Remove your clothes," one of them said. The lower half of this fellow's face was swollen and pink as a conch shell. The shadow of the hood covered his eyes. "I'm not a wealthy man, but I have some money back at my home," the merchant said, his voice tense and thin. "It's not that far from here. I'll gladly pay ye if ye let me go." "Remove your clothes," the hooded figure repeated, threatening the merchant with a flogging stick. When he was naked, they laid him on the table and clamped the restraints on his arms and ankles. Then they left him lying there alone in the dark on the table's cool surface with his fears and feelings of vulnerability. He waited a long time. Finally, someone emerged from the shadows. This figure, too, wore a hood, a green one, the same green as the moss on the griffins outside. He faced away from the direct rays of the candles, so the merchant couldn't see him clearly, but he could make out a silky flow of blonde beard, very straight, that fell out onto the figure's chest. "Who are ye?" the merchant asked. "And what do ye want from me?" "Didn't they tell ye?" the reply came, calm and level. "I'm the craftsman. An artist of sorts." "Artist?" The craftsman drifted to the table. He reached out, his hand long and slender and covered thickly on the back with hair of the same color and texture as the beard. He touched the merchant's bare chest, caressed the swell of his potbelly. "This is nice," he said, gently pinching the belly fat. "Please don't hurt me. Where are ye from?"
"From here."
"From Carcosa. I run an import business here with my brother. Spices and herbs." The merchant hoped to connect with this man as a fellow human being. "I was headed to Valdemar to pick up a shipment of myrrh when one of my oxen went lame on me, and I became separated from the caravan."
"On the merchant road?"
"Aye. Nearly to the border. Not a safe place to be alone. In the night, I take it?"
"In the night.
I thought if I pulled the wagon off the road into the trees, I'd be all right. But they found me and they brought me here."
"So you live in Carcosa? Have ye ever seen the mountain monster who they say lurks about here?"
"What do they call him?"
"The Moonlight Shambler."
The craftsman chuckled.
"Aye.
Have ye ever seen him?" This line of conversation made the merchant especially ill at ease. "I haven't seen him, but some of my wife's family has.
Some neighbors, too. We live in Carcosa proper. The Shambla is more of a rural presence. In the woodlands. Near the mountains, like ye say. I live in the mountains, and I've never seen him."
"What do ye suppose that means?" Maybe he's just a myth, the merchant suggested.
Did Philin Gaudai tell ye anything about why ye here?
He just taunted me. Like he knew something he wasn't sharing.
What do ye think of Chara?
The woman who escorted ye in.
Recalling the bubble-fleshed woman, the merchant weighed his words carefully.
She had a nice voice,
he said.
Chara's my wife, and I think she's beautiful. We've been together for 10 years.
10 glorious years.
I find beauty to be a subjective concept.
Don't ye agree?
I, the merchant said, not sure where this was going.
People say this is beautiful, and this is ugly. This smells wonderful, and this smells fetid.
One person tastes food and finds it delicious beyond description. Another eats the same food and finds it repulsive.
Ultimately, none of it makes sense.
We like what we like.
The merchant said nothing.
We all have our own aesthetic, but I find the popular ones to be a tad mundane.
Take yourself, for instance. Your skin is smooth, your limbs proportionate, your face symmetrical. You're of a set shape and stature that those around you no doubt find pleasing or at least non-offensive. But how would these same people react to ye if your skin was rugged as tree bark, if ye had hands that grew out of your shoulders with no arms to back them up, if your face was all lopsided and badly scarred? Would they still find ye non-offensive? Or would they laugh at ye, make fun of ye, lord their smooth, proportionate, symmetrical appearances over ye?
The craftsman moved to the foot of the table, and the merchant had to strain his neck to see him.
Here the face aligned with the candlelight, and the merchant saw it was covered entirely in silky, straight blonde hair, the cheeks, the nose, the forehead, the hollows of the eyes.
The craftsman's face was covered like a dog's face, hairy on every patch of skin.
He looked over the merchant with appraising eyes, as if doing some arithmetic problem in his head.
"What are you going to do with me?" the merchant asked.
The craftsman tugged thoughtfully at his chin hair.
"First," he said slowly, "I'm going to cut off your thumbs."
The next year evolved into an unending blur of pain for the merchant. Just as he was about to recover from one of the craftsman's procedures, a new one was introduced. After losing his thumbs, he lost his ears, most of his nose, the second and fourth toes of each foot, and half of his lower lip. His skin was alternately boiled, branded, burned, and tattooed. He took a spin on the webbed wheel and got to know the bite of its skewers. At first, he had begged the craftsman to desist. He groveled, blubbered, cajoled. His pathetic pleas for mercy devolving into guttural shrieks and moans, heartrending to hear. Still, the unaffected craftsman continued in his grim endeavors. All of the merchant's fingernails were permanently removed, as were his testicles and tongue. One cheekbone felt the crack of the craftsman's mallet, caving in part of the merchant's face and causing the eye on that side to droop, and his left forearm was snapped and reset at an angle, limiting the usefulness of that hand. Every other tooth was plucked from his head. Irritants were introduced to his eyes. Not all the procedures were successful. An attempt by the craftsman to arrange strips of skin to hang loosely across the merchant's abdomen failed when the skin's strips hardened and decomposed. These left horrible scars that turned red and threatened to become dangerously infected. An attempt to reshape the merchant's anus resulted in scar tissue that made his every defecation a new torture. Eventually, he surrendered to the suffering, drawing an obscene peace and wisdom from its dark cradle. When the pincers and the shears came out, he sank away within himself, into an exquisite loneliness, a world beyond words where no one could touch him, and the raw mysteries of life lay strewn and exposed like jewels in the moonlight. His mind passed over them, and he shared the knowledge of mystic flagellants who whipped their skin until it bled, who ground their knees in broken glass for just a glimpse of the truth he came to possess. The merchant was aware of other victims there, but he never met them. Never even saw them. Just heard their cries and their moans through the iron door of his cell. But this was enough to make him feel a part of something, a fraternity of pain. He took some guilty comfort in this. At least he didn't suffer alone. One day, whilst still recovering from a shattered kneecap, the door of his cell opened, and Chara, the bubble-fleshed wife of the craftsman, stood in its threshold. The merchant wondered whether any of his teeth had been added to her necklace. "You're free to go," she said.
to exist as a freak or to kill yourself here. Whichever. But ye can't live here any longer. Live here?
He looked at her questioningly. She handed him a length of rope with which to hang himself, should he choose that path.
The craftsman is dead, she said, and moved on to the next door. The open doorway felt like a trap.
Holding the rope in his thumbless hands, he cautiously peered out into the corridor. Besides the woman, the two hooded assistants and the half-man were unlocking cells, delivering the news of the craftsman's demise and giving out lengths of rope. The merchant expected hordes of the tormented to flood out into the passageway, but no one did. All remained in their cells, stunned by this development, grappling with their decision in a way they had probably never thought they would. Occasionally they popped out their heads, to look around, to meet his gaze with terror in their eyes, their faces awash in scars and bruises and carvings, some more nearly resembling raisins than human countenances. Was that how he now appeared? He wondered whether freedom was worth a lifetime of gaping stares and crude jokes at his expense. To be mocked in the streets of his town by thoughtless youths, as he had seen done to others countless times. He couldn't imagine the horror his visage had come to represent, his cell and the torture chamber being mercifully devoid of mirrors and shiny surfaces. In the end, he chose to leave. He may have been the only one. He made his way across the dirt floor to the stairs, dragging behind him the leg with the injured kneecap. Castrated, voiceless, hacked, and scarred, he made his way up the steps, wincing with every movement, across the stone room to the great door which he struggled with to open, out into the morning sunlight which was so bright it made his eyes water. He looked back only once, to ensure he wasn't pursued, then he swung open the fence and proceeded down the mountain road into the woods. He journeyed through the forest, off the road, but keeping it within sight. He was afraid that on the road he would meet other travelers, and he feared what their reactions to him might be. He huddled down in the brush whenever one or more came along. How carefree they seemed. He remembered when he had felt that way. Throughout the day he made slow progress, his course winding alongside the trail through incessant trees, scrub, and ravines. His aching body protested every step of the way. By nightfall, he was worn out, sore and ravenous. He thought of his family. How would he even communicate with them? Through hieroglyphs scratched out in the mud? Perhaps, if they even allowed him close enough to make the attempt. He would find a way, he told himself. The forest grew scattered and thin. Up ahead by the light of the moon, he made out Junction Road, on the outskirts of his city proper. From here, he knew the way by heart. He could travel through alleys and back streets to avoid being seen, to the building where his family awaited, to his hearth and home. He was within a block of his goal when a dog began barking at him. From the black backside of a building stepped a man and a woman, coming his way. Another dog in another yard joined in, and the combined growling and baying grew more excited. Additional people emptied from additional buildings to see what the ruckus was. He tried to keep to the shadows, but a beam of light caught him and the half dozen or so who now gathered close to him let out a collective gasp.
"It's him!" an old voice shouted. "It's the Moonlight Shambler!"
They fell upon him with their sticks and knives, with their stones and balled fists. They hammered and jabbed at him, even as he held up his ruined hands in surrender. His monstrous body buffeted under the blows. He dropped to his shattered knee. He tried to cry out, but the only sound his toneless throat could make was a moan of despair as he tumbled to the eternal darkness that lies beyond all pain.